talk a little bit about Detroit using numbers from the last census, because people either think Detroit is now totally repaired and resurrected and perfect, or they think Detroit is a third world city that is hopeless. And very few people think anything in the middle. Hi, good morning. So I thought I'd give you the real numbers and give you a chance to ask about what the numbers mean. And then I'd take a little bit of time to talk about what's new at CAS since I was here a couple years ago, and answer questions to that. Does that sound okay? Good. So 139, that's the magic number. Do you know what that is? 139 some? Good. It's not my age. It's not even my weight. It certainly isn't my Social Security number. It's the number of square miles in the city of Detroit. Did you know it? Oh, I would have given you a prize. You shouldn't be so shy. Of course, I don't have any prizes, but I would have given you one. 139 square miles, which means it's a really large city. It's larger than most of the other cities you think about, New York, L.A., Chicago. In terms of land mass, it's huge. It's a really big city. Any idea about the population of the city of Detroit? Yeah, actually less. The last census says 672,795.
Does that include the suburban area?
It does not. Okay. Just the city of Detroit. Of course, in 1950, it was 1.8 million. So now you get a sense of the shrinkage or exodus from the city of Detroit. To put it in perspective, the six counties that are sort of the region, there are 4,297,000, so over 4 million, but in the city proper, less than 700,000. It's been in decline since the 1950s.
Has it ever been lower than that number, though?
No, this is the lowest we have been, which means that today we're the 23rd largest city in the United States. At one point, we were the fifth largest city in the United States. So in comparison to other municipalities, we haven't done so well. In terms of the racial breakdown, 80% African American, 8% Hispanic, 9% white, and 1% Asian. Does that surprise you? 80% African American, 9% white, 8% Hispanic, 1% Asian. The only demographic that's actually climbing? Hispanic. Southwest Detroit has been growing for the last 10 years anyway in large numbers, which makes it a really exciting part of the city to visit for food or entertainment, that kind of thing. Well, during the factories, Henry Ford offered $5 a day to come work in Detroit, and that made you enough money to launch you into the middle class. And what happened then is that white people began leaving and black people were staying. Now, more recently, middle class African Americans have left as well. But that's why you have a majority black city. And it has been for as long as I've been living in Detroit, and that's 32 years, so a long time.
Hey, the Asian number just shocks me, but there's lots of Asians. Are they out?
Correct. So if you go to places like Farmington Hills or Troy, there's rich diversity with Asians and Koreans.
Just not in the city.
Actually, I was telling a story the other night in class about Southwest. We were going to open a facility in Southwest Detroit, and I came back to the office, and one of my staff members confronted me and said, "Reverend Fowler, you can't do it." I said, "Why?" She said, "Because African Americans and Hispanic people don't mix." See, what happened is the minorities were sort of set up against each other. I know they weren't minorities in the city, but so they're very defined boundaries in terms of Hispanic and black. Foreign-born of the total population, 37,000, most of them Mexican, 15,000 of them Mexican. The rest are between Middle Eastern, Bangladesh, Yemen, Iraq. So the governor suggested not too long ago that we try and recruit people from foreign countries, that foreigners bring in new ideas and energy and a work ethic I haven't seen that happen necessarily, but it is one notion to repopulate.
What about the Muslim population?
Yeah, mostly Dearborn. Mostly, not exclusively, but mostly Dearborn. The western side of Detroit, some too, but mostly not. I don't have the religious breakdown. You have certainly a large number of Chaldean folks, but primarily Detroit is a Christian city, and mostly it's a Black Baptist city in terms of Christian. Oh, yeah. If you want to get something done in the city of Detroit, and it's political in nature, you would go to the Black Baptist pastors who would endorse you or not, whether they thought it was good for the larger community. Yeah. Many, many storefronts. So occasionally somebody will say to me, what Detroit needs are churches. There are plenty of churches. They just don't look like the churches you're used to seeing. They're storefront churches, right? People start small and grow a congregation and then move into a larger building, but perhaps not an institutional-looking church. Age. City of Detroit is experiencing growth between 25 and 34-year-old people. Why is that, do you know? 25 to 34-year-old people. Yeah, young people are moving back into the city of Detroit. Yeah, a lot of friends, right. So they finish college, they want to do something new and exciting, they move into the city, primarily downtown, midtown, Corktown. Those areas or communities are thriving with new folks. Let me tell you a story. When I started a cast, we had prostitutes working next to our building on the steps of an apartment building, and they made $10 a half an hour. Don't ask me how I know that. I just do. In that very same location, right next to the church, is a new condominium building where the condos start at $475,000 a piece, and they're all sold before it opened. That's the difference. And who are buying those condos? Well, some people who are retired and don't have kids anymore, they're moving back into the city because it's walkable. Pedestrian is important as we age. And they're young people who have lucrative jobs because they have great education and have landed something with Quicken Loans or one of the hospitals or one of the tech firms downtown, and they're able to afford something of that. You know, I can't. But it's amazing that shift in 24 years. And some of that is to appeal to more people, young people, educated, artistic people, to move back into the city. It hasn't happened so much in the neighborhoods. So Corktown's really the first neighborhood, Woodbridge, Corktown, to have that happen. Some in the old sort of affluent neighborhoods, Boston Edison, Indian Village, is seeing this sort of resurgence too, but not in the numbers that we're seeing in the downtown neighborhood. Household size, 2.6. There's a decline in the number of houses that have families with kids. Since the year 2000, the number of households that have kids has declined by 43%. I know. I mean, that should jump out and just slap you in the face. Why is that? Why are the families leaving while the young people are coming? Schools are lousy. I mean, even if you could afford a $475,000 condo with kids, you then would have to pay for private schools if you don't think the quality is up to your standard, or you'd have to ship them to the suburbs every day.
Why are the schools so good?
Oh, that's a longer discussion. I only have an hour.
And there's
so much money in charter schools. So let me qualify, because that's a good question. Some of the charter schools are decent. Some of the public schools are decent. If you talk about a Renaissance High or the High School for the Fine Arts or Cass Technical, those are all great schools. If your kids are in those schools, they're as good as any suburban school. Some of the charter schools are good, but not all of them. Just because they're a charter school doesn't mean they're good, and it doesn't mean it's good for the children in the city, because what it does is it takes dollars away from the public schools and leaves many of the families that don't have education as a priority. I'm trying to say it in a politically correct way, but You understand what I'm saying. So it's bad overall for the kids in Detroit. It's bad for the teachers in charter schools, too. They're paid less. Their expectation for education is less. So a friend of mine, her son went to teach music in a charter school. He got there. They didn't have any instruments. They didn't have any music. None of the kids had ever had instrumental music before, and he was just supposed to start a band. So that's the kind of thing that can happen in a brand new school where, you know, maybe their idea is a great one, but it takes time to figure things out. So now in the city of Detroit, 26% of the households have kids, 31% don't have kids, and 44% are non-related family members. So lots of people living together that don't have children. In terms of educational attainment, remember the new people moving in, they're just a minority of the overall population. So 22% of the people living in Detroit over the age of 25 don't have a high school diploma. So almost a quarter of the city doesn't have a high school diploma. Another 33% has either a high school diploma or a GED, which is an equivalent as you're going for work. So roughly, you know, 55% of the city either has high school or not. Now compete for jobs. 26% has some college, 7% has an associate's degree, only 15% of the city has a bachelor's or better. So you've got a real challenge in terms of education, because education tends to make for better living, right? Detroit Public Schools, in answer to your question about charters a little bit, 45,000 students. So a lot of kids still go to DPS schools. The graduation rate is 78%. I don't know how that compares. I was actually surprised. I thought it was pretty good. So I don't know if they're taking dropout rates into consideration. I'd have to do a little more research. In terms of income, for the past 15 years, the median income in the city of Detroit has declined. Okay, now we're having fun. A third of the households, not people, in the city of Detroit make $15,000 a year or less. A third of the city. Now, when I talk about housing and assets later, you're going to understand why it's so important. You can never get ahead. You can never get ahead. 57% of the children live in poverty, 20% of the seniors live in poverty. In terms of the economy, there are 30 jobs for every 100 residents who are old enough to work. And transportation is dismal. If you don't have a car, a reliable car, you're not getting to jobs in the suburbs because it's not set up that way. There was a story a couple years ago about a man from the city who walked and took a bus and a bike and everything else to get to Rochester every day. That's pretty much what you'd have to do to get to jobs. Okay, a few more and then I'll open up to questions. Health, we have higher rates of diseases, unfortunately, although we're right in the middle smack dab of some of the best medical institutions in the state. You know, Harper, Hutzel, Women's, Receiving, the VA, Ford. I mean, you go right down the list. Some of the best hospitals in the country are in Detroit. And yet we have 14% asthma rate, 18% diabetes rate, 800 people infected with HIV per 100,000. Maybe that sounds good to you, maybe it sounds bad. Let me give you the comparison. 800 in Detroit, 163 in Michigan. So quadruple. 14%, 14 out of 100,000 infant mortality. Maybe that sounds good. 7 in Michigan, 6 in the U.S. This one didn't sound nearly as bad to me. 499 cancer rate per 100,000 in Detroit, 440 in Michigan, 439 in the U.S. I mean, many of the things are environmental factors. For instance, and it seems funny to say that here where many of the houses are older, 73% are single-family housing, 92% of the housing in Detroit was built before 1980. Why is that important? Asbestos and lead-based paint. Yeah, so you got kids eating lead-based paint and getting sick because of it. Let me stick on housing for a minute. Vacancy. There are 365,000 housing units in Detroit. 109,000 of them are vacant. So a third of the city are houses that are vacant. And so when they say to me, Reverend Fowler, well, how many homeless people are there? I say, I really can't tell you, because many are squatting in vacant houses with no electricity, no water, no heat, but they're off the street, and so they don't get counted. Actually, I think I saw the front page of yesterday's paper was talking about squatters and city-owned property. I didn't get a chance to read it, but I saw the picture in the headline. But that is very true, that I know people are squatting, sometimes in small groups, sometimes as families, sometimes as individuals. Sometimes the houses get caught on fire because they're trying to stay warm. Like hacking their neighbor's electricity. Oh, yes. Well, of course. Yeah. Of the 139 square miles, 24 of them are vacant land. 24 square miles of the city of Detroit are vacant land. Why is that a problem? Aren't we farming in Detroit? Haven't you read about all our urban farming? That should be good news, right? It's a lot to police, it's a lot to light, it's a lot to cut, and so consequently they don't light and they don't cut, and then you have more illegal dumping, right, and more acts of criminal activity going on. And who wants to live next to all that vacant land? If you wanted to live in a rural area, you'd move to a rural area. You're living in a city, maybe you have the only house on the block that is occupied and is surrounded by overgrown weeds and tires and crap. And the other houses, they're filled with squatters who are trying to steal your electricity, right? So it's not a good situation. And many of them are seniors who can't defend themselves, who've lived there for decades, raised their kids there, don't want to move. That's where their memories are. So it's a huge, huge problem. For the first time, the last census told us that we have more renters than we have homeowners in the city of Detroit. It's almost an even split, but it's not a good sign that you want homeownership, because you have a different understanding of the neighborhood and your commitment to it as a homeowner than a renter. So 49% are homeowned, 51% are renter-occupied. In addition, I would point out that 58% of the renters are what we call cost-burdened, meaning they spend more than a third of their income on their housing. However, 37% of the renters spend more than 50% of their income on housing. So don't get sick. Don't let your car break down. Don't have any other kind of need or crisis because you're a renter. You have no collateral for a loan, and you're spending all your money to keep a roof over your head and the utilities on. Let me give you some good news, and then I'll stop for some questions. Detroit currently is leading the region with new residential permits, meaning we're building more. So 1,076 in 2016, that's a first. So there are signs peppered around the city, if you will, of new life and viability since the bankruptcy. But the truth is, we're not totally healed, and the truth is, we're not totally helpless. That we're a city of two stories right now, mainly divided between the downtown section and the neighborhoods. And there's real debate about that, especially as we look at who's going to be mayor and who's going to be governor, about how the city is going to move forward. How long can you ignore the neighborhoods to get downtown humming again until everybody who's not downtown leaves, right, or dies? Yeah?
What your community cast in the midst of this picture? Because you can't minister the whole community.
Right. Yes, it does. Actually, yesterday was the first Sunday. We have a new associate minister, Reverend John Reynolds, who's out of the Rochester St. Paul Church. He did a fabulous job there of starting a second congregation. And so we nabbed him because we know we have to enlist that new community to be a part of Cass Church. If we don't, the church will die because all the people with no money, they're being forced out. right? And they don't have the cars and whatnot to drive back to come to our church. And so part of the strategy, if you will, is to relate to that new community. And by the way, we're surrounded by other churches that have started satellite locations all around us because they see the new community and they're trying to reach out to them. So the future of the church, if there is one, we don't have a model anywhere. What we do have in the church, Protestant denominations anyway, is churches go from affluent to middle class to poor. What we have to do is go from poor to affluent. And nobody has done it that I'm aware of. And so walking that tight wire of continuing to be in ministry with poor people and attract affluent people is going to take God, in addition to Reverend Reynolds, right? Is it possible? I think all things are possible, but it's a careful walk. So somebody yesterday said after church, well, it doesn't feel like the church I used to go to, meaning all homeless and very poor people. Well, it can't, because the neighborhood isn't what it used to be. Now, our social services is 4 miles up on the lodge in a different neighborhood, because when I started, the Community Development Corporation told me, you can't rent from us anymore, we want the homeless out. I said, okay. So we started a whole new, and now it's a campus offering more than we ever did before, including a worship service and a Bible study that are optional. So it's not that we're not doing churchy religious things with them, it's just in a different location. So again, it's a tight wire there. You'll have to ask me to come back in 10 years to tell me how it worked, because right now it's a wing and a prayer. But I think it'll work. I'm hopeful it'll work. But it'll be a different church.
Your shelter is male only? Does it
Oh, no. Let me... are there any other Detroit questions? And I'll come back to Cass. Yes.
I'm curious, do you have a St. Vincent de Paul? Do you have any other collaborative groups you interface with? In other words, are there any other?
Yeah, we definitely are not the only provider of services in the city of Detroit. So when we work with developmentally disabled people, we also work with Goodwill and STEP. When we work with homeless people, we work with COTS and Mariners Inn and Rescue Ministry and Salvation Army. So we do all kinds of collaborative stuff. I hate to say it, there's only so many dollars, and if they all go to somebody else, that's good for them, and you close down your service. Can you help me? Thank you. You close down your services. So what you're going to see on the inside of this is a map of the campus we began creating in 2002 when we opened our first residential building in response to the Community Development Corporation telling us we couldn't have homeless people anymore. It's right here. And the very first building we opened was the OBGYN annex to the former Crittenden Hospital that's now in Rochester. Crittenden Hospital. Well, that's the building we have. Yep, right. So in 2002, we opened our first residential programs in that facility. Does everybody have one? Because I can go without one. I know this stuff. Okay. Did you want one? Okay. All right. Good. So we do four things: food, housing, healthcare, and jobs. That's all we do. We that's enough. And we try and do what nobody else is doing so that it gets done if it needs to be done. So in the C building right off Woodrow Wilson, that was the Crittenden Annex and the first thing we opened here in 2002 when the nonprofit was formed. It hosts our kitchen, which prepares and serves 700,000 meals a year. Using some urban gardening, we all summer long grow, vegetables that we can use. We this fall are getting, it's what's called a freight farm. Any idea? A freight farm?
It's like a car,
isn't it? Almost. You're right in thinking mobile. So the Ford Motor Fund gave us money. Actually, it's the Ford Foundation and Bill Ford gave us money to buy this shipping container that's recycled and retrofitted so that we can grow hydroponically and vertically, like on blinds. In that farm, we'll be able to grow lettuce and greens and herbs and radishes all year round. Doesn't matter what the weather is like outside, with less water and little electricity, most of it solar. And that one shipping container, which is 40 by 10 by 8, will grow the equivalent of 1.8 acres of farmland. I know. So we are hyped beyond, and it means that people all year long in our soup kitchen will get fresh, free, organic stuff. We already cook from scratch. We have a very good chef who's able to do that. So we're trying to be healthy because poor people tend not to have access to the best food. We are two bus rides away from a grocery store, so we started a small store in another building where people can come shop for very inexpensive prices and be safe. Because folks were getting, they were shopping at the gas stations and the liquor stores and getting held up on the way back to our premises. So that's what, we started that about 3 years ago and it's gone very well. So you can buy anything in a can for a quarter, anything in a box, three for a dollar. I mean, so it's giving them the dignity of buying and selecting their own, and yet it's not robbing them. Okay, so that's the food program. We grow some of it. We're donated some of it. We cook our own. We provide box food to people in houses that have run out of money and run out of food, as well as making the food we offer. Housing. This is an answer to your question, Melody. We house 300 people a night. Men, women, and children, an emergency shelter, meaning they can't get into a regular shelter, but they can come in a day at a time. Actually, we don't put them out. Some people do. We don't put them out. You can stay around the clock. We have a women and children's emergency warming center, a family shelter for homeless women and children, a rotating shelter using area churches for men and women. Then we have permanent supportive housing, where you can stay permanently with some supports if you want to, and then most recently, the tiny homes. The tiny homes is a distinctive, unique program in the country at this point, although lots of people are aiming to replicate what we've done. You can see them in the G section. We purchased 2.5 blocks, 26 lots for $15,000. I always like to say, look out, Dan Gilbert. I'm pretty good at... Each house is between 250 and 400 square feet, so they're truly tiny. Each house goes on a 30 by 100 foot lot, and we're adding solar to it this summer, so it'll eat up a little bit of their backyard. They are for formerly homeless, senior citizens, and kids who, young adults who have aged out of foster care, all of whom are low income. In terms of the first seven residents, they're average monthly income was $988 a month, meaning they make less than $12,000 a year. So you know they would never qualify for a mortgage, not even a Habitat mortgage. And Habitat's a great organization, no interest on their loans. I mean, I have high praise for Habitat. But our people would never, which means they'd rent their whole life. And probably they'd be a part of that more than 50% of your income going to your rent. And so you have no collateral. You have nothing you can sell. You have nothing you can leave your kids. Here, they live there for 7 years. During the 7 years, they go to homeownership groups where they can talk about how to solve problems, how to do preventative maintenance. Everybody gets a financial coach to make sure they have a budget and a savings account, a checking account. Can you earn more income, which is a key thing for affordable housing. In affordable housing, generally speaking, if you make more money, you pay more rent, which means that people either don't want to make more money or they don't disclose that they make more money. And I didn't want to make them liars. So our coach says, can you make more money? Can you do hair? Can you do nails? Can you shovel snow? Can you walk a dog? Can you babysit? Even if you make $50 a month, that's $600 a year. And if you're living on, you know, $8,000 a year, an extra $600 is all right. Then the coach says, can we make your money make money for you? It's your money. You don't have to do this. But have you thought about a savings bond? Or a CD at your bank or credit union? Have you thought about a stock? Let's start small. Because in 7 years, they're going to own the home, and they're going to need a financial cushion when they're PTEC unit goes or the refrigerator goes, it'll be up to them, right? They also have to volunteer 8 hours a month. So we do it in reverse of Habitat. Habitat does it before you move in with the volunteers. We do it after you move in with the community, so they get to know their neighbors, not only in the tiny houses, but all over the neighborhood. They work the CB patrol. They staff the Halloween party, the Christmas giveaway. So they become seen as a resource to the community. By the way, our community has had nothing new built in it since 1974, and it was a garage. So the larger community is ecstatic that we're building these houses. They come by taking selfies and videos and peering in the windows, standing on our bushes, which makes me really mad. And the cops stop, DTE stops. People come from all over the country to see them now.
How do you have a criteria?
I just pick my friends. No, I'm kidding.
I mean, it's hard.
Yes, it is. Well, let me tell you the real story. Because we were getting so much media attention, we had to advertise for applications before we were ready. But we look at your housing history, your financial status, your criminal history, references, and then an interview. So it's serious vetting, because in 1 month's time, we had 122 applications for 25 houses. And then we cut it off. But during the next 6 months, we had 900 inquiries for applications. So 1,000 people wanted to live in 25 houses, which I find funny, because one of my board members said during the business plan stage of this, do you think anybody will want to live in those houses? Yep,